Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, March 29th, the anonymous sex question box edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm an editor at Slate, and I'm the father of Eliza, age 7, and Leo, who is 3.5.
I'm Rebecca Lavoy. I'm a journalist and podcaster. I live in New Hampshire, and my kids are Henry, who's 16, Teddy, who's 15, and my stepdaughter, Lily, who is 17.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster based in Oakland, California, and I'm the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 15.
Today on our show, we've got a question from a mom whose daughter has a mysterious and ambiguous genetic abnormality. First up, though, let's do triumphs and fails. I have an ongoing fail that I'm elevating to the status of, like, Mom and Dad Are Fighting fail, in part as an accountability measure, because I got to get on this. Eliza got a bike for her birthday. She's had it now for almost 5 months. I have not taught her to ride it. In my defense, it's been winter. The weather has not always been great. If I take both of them out to the park and they're wearing their big coats and I'm supposed to, like, teach her how to ride a bike and he's standing there shivering and that's no good. But also, I am nervous that I'm not going to really know how to teach somebody how to ride a bike, or that she's going to have a hard time getting it because she is that kind of stuff doesn't always come easy to her. And I think now that it's been several months and it's time for me to categorize, there's been some nice weather weekends and it's time for me to categorize this as a fail in the hope that, like, in a couple weeks I can tell you about the triumph of, like, I taught her how to ride the bike.
Yep. That's a tough one. Kevin never taught Lily how to ride a bike. She doesn't know how to ride a bike.
She's, that's what I'm afraid of.
17 years old. And yeah, it's because he and her mom, yeah, they had so much anxiety about her not being good at it and having an accident and all that stuff, because she was a klutzier little kid than the other kids were. And I was always, it was one of the things that we, like, argued about a lot when she was younger. But yeah, she doesn't know how to do it. So that's yeah. If you don't want to have a freak who doesn't know how to ride a bike, get on it, Gabe.
Right. You got to avoid the self-fulfilling prophecy. She'll probably be great at riding a bike. She's probably going to win the Tour de France, and we're going to come back to this podcast. All right. That's my fail. Rebecca, what about you? Triumph or fail?
Well, I've got a quick triumph, which is that Henry made us a pie from scratch last night, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. Oh. It was really good. But the fail is, I actually got an email from a listener to this show who pointed out that often when I introduce who my kids are at the beginning of the show, I say my sons Henry, who is 16, and Teddy, who is 15, and then I sometimes say my beautiful stepdaughter Lily, who is 17. And this listener, I think, correctly pointed out that it's a little bit sexist that I would feel the need to use that adjective, or only use that adjective toward her. But I do want to say that is a fail. But what the listener doesn't know, perhaps, is that Henry, who is in the credits of two other podcasts that we produce here because he works on them, is known in those credits as our very handsome line producer, Henry Lavoy. And I do think that I was trying to maybe compensate for that a little bit by describing Lily as my beautiful stepdaughter, Lily, because there has been some eye rolling at the constant talking on social media about Henry Lavoy as the very handsome line producer, Henry Lavoy. So that is the origin of that. And I don't disagree that it is not the right message to be sending to just introduce girls as beautiful being, like, the obvious adjective. Obviously, Lily is also bright, ambitious, cool, fun, all the things that you'd possibly want in a daughter or stepdaughter. So my bad. I'll do my best to curb it in the future. But there is an origin story. I just wanted to clarify.
I think it's too bad that Teddy is so hideous that you can't even characterize his appearance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right. You're
right.
He's a troll.
It really is. Yeah.
Poor guy. And Teddy, who we keep in a closet.
My closet son, Teddy.
You know what? There's no competitive, like, stuff between Teddy and Lily at all, but there is a little bit between Henry and Lily because they're so much more similar in age. And, you know, Lily's a senior in high school. Henry's a junior. Henry's is like super high achiever. Lily's about to go to college. So, you know, I do sometimes maybe play into that a little bit, the overcompensation, you know.
Well, that is the thing when you have two kids, is like this feeling of you sort of feel like you do a lot of something with one kid, so you try to match it with the other kid, but then the first kid is like, but it feels like you're specifically just singling out the second kid, but no one knows that you're doing it in response to the one. It gets messy. It's hard. I mean,
right.
There is that constant feeling of competition.
Yeah, there's that thing of, you are so smart. And of course, you are also very smart.
Yeah, no, it's like, well, why am I also smart? Why wasn't I so smart to begin with? Like, what's that about, Dad?
We do have fun. Carvel, triumph or fail?
It might have been a parenting fail, but an educational system triumph. This morning I was riding in the car with Georgia and we're on our way to school and she just blurted out a sex fact that I don't even think I can repeat it on the air. She just said it out. Dad, did you know that blah, 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 blah? And I was like, the what? Like, why are you saying these words? Like, what is this?
Well, you got
to
give us a little more than that. Come
I
on.
Really, I don't know if I...
Is there a metaphor?
Okay, I'll say it. Well, that's the point. No, there's no... She goes, literally, we were in the car, moment of silence, and she goes, Dad, my teacher says cum tastes like salt. And I was like, what is that? Why? Where would that sentence, how would that be a thing? That's literally what she said. And I was like, I joked. I was like, did my 12-year-old daughter just say that to me at 8:15 in the morning? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, what is that? She's like, oh, that was one of the questions. So they take this sex ed class and they do the curriculum, but then there's also this private question box where kids can ask any question that they have about anything. They can put it on a box and the teacher will answer them. The questions are anonymous. And so Georgia was like, yes, that's what she said. She wasn't asking me. She was announcing it as a fact. And I was like, I don't really know what to say to that. And then it opened up this whole conversation about the way sex is being taught and what have you. And it was really interesting because I like realized how incredibly uncomfortable I was with every aspect of the conversation. And so I was asking her like, well, is there any teacher's questions that your teacher doesn't answer? And she's like, yeah, she can't answer any personal questions. I was like, well, what? She was like some kid asked, when's the last time your husband gave it to you? And I was like, you have a 57-year-old man in your class? Like, what the fuck? Who says that? Like, so we had like a laugh around that. So she was like, she won't answer any personal questions, but she'll answer any questions. And she was like giving me examples of all these questions that were both silly, but also the kinds of things that questions you have about sex when you're trying to make sense of the, you know, when you're like 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. And so this is, so like the conversation unfolded more and more. And like, I like try to be, you know, I consider myself like a cool, hip, with it dad, he said, you know, finger gun pointingly. But the reality is like, this actually made me super uncomfortable. And I was like, whoa. And so the conversation continued and I was aware that I had this discomfort about it. And I was sort of joking with Georgia about it, but she had so little. She was just this and the kid said that and we heard learn this. And I used to think that, but then my teacher said this and everything. And so at the end of it, she said, the other question I have for you, Dad, is like, why is everyone so embarrassed about sex? Like, obviously it happens. Obviously everyone does it. Like, we're all here. So why is everyone like super embarrassed about it? And I was like, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. Because we were all shamed for it growing up. And like, all we were ever told was just like, don't say that. Don't talk about that. That's not appropriate. And no one really understood why. So we just got told. I was like, your mother and I just grew up that way. We were just told that this is not appropriate. This is not right. Don't say this. This is embarrassing. Shame on you. How dare you? And then as a result, the next thing that happens is you decide to break that taboo, or you see that taboo getting broken, and then you become obsessed with breaking the taboo. So then there's like this obsession with sex. It's got to be everywhere. And every time someone says penis, everyone has to giggle for 400 minutes. And then every, you know, and like everyone's got to like turn everything into that. And as a society, we obviously do not have a working, healthy relationship to this thing, to this natural thing. And like, to the point where I like didn't even want to talk about this stuff on the air, which is so ridiculous because clearly everyone has sex. And so it just really made me, it really struck me as interesting. And so then the next question, so then the conversation went on, and this may get to a question a lot of listeners have. Georgia goes, she says, but this part where people, where she answers the random, like, weird sex questions that seventh graders have, she was like, that's not what the curriculum is. That we did that last semester, like the mechanics of sex. This semester is all about consent. That's all we talk about, is like various forms of consent, what consent is, how consent can be discussed, and all the questions around it and all the confusing parts about it and how to address it. And so this part where we do the question and answer is only just like this tiny little section at the beginning of class. And so I was like, well, so when you do this question and answer stuff, do people, like, how did the group respond at the beginning? Are people giggling? Is it whatever? She was like, well, I mean, obviously at the beginning, it was really like people would laugh. It's the first time someone said, like, whatever funny sex word that you weren't supposed to say in school, everyone just laughed. And, you know, but the teacher just kind of waited us out. And then she was like, but literally by like the second week, no one, it was just class. It was just school for everyone. No one was really like freaked out by these words or obsessed with these things. And I don't know. And then she returned back to her thing. Like, so why, it keeps making me wonder, why is everyone so panicked about it? And I don't know. I've just been, that conversation just happened like 3 hours ago, and I've just been turning it over and over in my head and trying to get a handle on how I feel about all of it. But I think, and I want to hear what other people think, I think that part of where we're so confused about sex is that we grew up being totally unclear about how to talk about it. And so communication suffers, and a lot of shitty things can happen when there's bad communication in the realm of something that has such potential for damage. And it's kind of impressive to me that it seems like, at least what I'm seeing, these kids like have a much easier time communicating about it. They don't view the talking about it as any kind of barrier whatsoever. And I think that bodes well.
There's one thing I wonder, and I can't tell if this is just me being a prude. Like, maybe this is just me being uptight about talking about sex. But when the good thing about the anonymous suggestion box or the anonymous question box is that then, like, if you have a question, then you can get your question answered by an authority figure who will give you a straight answer. Does it also have the effect that, like, the kids who are the most advanced and who have the most sophisticated questions get to sort of put their questions in front of a room full of kids, some of whom are not at the point where they're even thinking about those questions yet? Like, there's kids in that room who hadn't even thought that there might be a taste of cum. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But how does that hurt?
I mean, this. Yeah, that. Thank you. That's exactly. So that's the problem we had. So when they were in elementary school, they had puberty education in fifth grade, not sex ed, but puberty ed. And puberty ed was very focused on, here's how your body's changing, here's what a period is, here's a, you know. And so, like, all that happened, and they took those classes together. Like, when I was a kid, our crew cut ass gym teacher took all the boys aside and, like, mumbled a few things, and then was like, use a condom, and then just put us back in, you know, in general population. And so we didn't understand any of it. And what happened in my kids' elementary school is that they had this semester-long puberty ed class taught by this woman who was really great. Like, she met with all the parents beforehand. We loved her. We thought she was so funny, so smart, so good at teaching this material to this age group. And so Ezra took that class first. Georgia hadn't taken it. And then Ezra would get in the car, and he'd just be like, blah, 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 penis, blah, 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 masturbation. And I'd be like, no, stop it. Like, your sister is, like, third grade. She's not ready for this. But it really made me question, I don't know. It was confusing, and I never really got to an answer. But it did make me wonder, like, that is a fear, that a person's going to be introduced to some content that they're not able, that they shouldn't be introduced to. But then it's like, well, why shouldn't they be introduced to it? I mean, with a fifth grader and a third grader, that's more of an issue. But with a room full of all seventh graders, it does make me wonder if that's even a problem.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think if there are some kids that are there, then they all benefit from learning, because it's not like you can put the kids who aren't there yet in a bubble and not have them exposed to kids who are thinking about sex and talking about sex and perhaps starting to have sex. They're going to hear about it. And wouldn't you rather they get information earlier, accurate information earlier, before they even thought of the question, than terrible through the grapevine information in the lunchroom after they thought of the question, and that's actually what their education is, you know? I mean, I to me, I only see upside in them having accurate information from a trusted adult sooner rather than later. I really do. I only now, as you know, it makes a difference. My kids are a little older. My son in particular is in a relationship. So I think about this stuff all the time. But like, we talked about sex when he was really young, and like, he had a really great education around it. And I remember, like, around that same age, a huge part of the curriculum, there was a consent stuff, and there was also like the conversation around, and I know it was designed around the consent stuff, around pleasure stuff, where like, if it's not fun for both people, it's not right. Like, that was part of the conversation. And I remember talking about it, thinking like, how smart is it to frame it that way? Like, it's a smart thing to do. And it's a healthy thing to do, you know, in a way. But I will just take umbrage with one thing you said, Carvel. Even if we were all really open about it all the time, penises are still really funny, and I would still probably do it
first time somebody said it. This is true. This is true. I mean, I hear where Gabe is coming from, because that I don't have an answer. It just raised all these questions for me as a, like, it's like, why? Okay, so like, if a kid is like, doesn't know algebra, and then they get to seventh grade and the people are doing algebra and they're balancing equations, we're not like, why, you know, don't expose my kid to algebra yet? Because, you know, it's like, well, that's what you're supposed to know by seventh grade, is this is what we're learning. And I'm not saying it's an exact metaphor, but it makes me wonder specifically how this content is, how and why it should be treated differently.
I mean, I think it's unavoidable that sex has emotional weight to it that's different from algebra, right? That like, kids and adults and everybody has feelings about sex that, like, that's intrinsic to the subject. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing to talk about. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't educate kids about it. It doesn't mean that it's shameful. But it does mean that it's not, like, neutral information, and that you might want to be aware of what information you're presenting to kids of at what age and in what way. Now, what Rebecca points out is that kids are also getting their information through all of these back channels that are much more chaotic and crazy than having a teacher answer questions from a box in front of the class. And I'm sure that's absolutely right. I do sort of just wonder, as a kid who, like, I remember being a kid who, as we were all sort of finding out about this stuff, was like, whoa, that's a bit heavy. I do wonder if, like, I could have been sitting in that classroom and felt like, whoa, this all feels like a bit much right now. On the other hand,
I wonder,
like,
about that.
Yeah, they're getting
because
it somewhere.
Part of the reason I think that I felt like it was a bit much and a bit heavy was because it was always attached to, like, secret back alley stuff and shady grownups who showed me shit that they shouldn't have. That was the way that I came to understand it. So I came to understand sex as a whole as, like, this illicit, fucked up thing that shady people did and introduced to you in ways that they shouldn't. And there was no normalization of it. It never changed over the course of my life. That was always the context. It wasn't until I was, like, well into my 20s and in the Bay Area before someone, like, in a clean, well-lit place talked openly about the intricacies of sex in my presence. And I was like, well, I wish someone had done this a long time ago. I'd probably feel a lot less freaked out by a lot more things, you know? And, like, I don't know that that's the case for everyone. And, like, this is, you know, this thing, like, it had a consent at the beginning. We went through the curriculum. We sort of did everything. I remembered about the question box. I was surprised. I mean, I didn't know that this was going to be in the question box, but it shouldn't be surprising, because this is the kind of stuff kids are asking about. And the stuff that they're asking about is the stuff that, the rumor stuff that we didn't know the answer to when I was in that. I mean, I thought you could get mouth pregnant well into middle school. Like, I didn't have a grown-up I could ask that to. There was no grown-up I could ask that to. There was no Google I could ask that to. There was nothing. I just had to, like, wait until someone came and disabused me of that notion. And then I felt really embarrassed and ashamed for having thought that in the first place, because it was like, you were, you know, some older kid had to be like, no, you idiot, that's not blah, 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 you know? And so the whole thing just sucked. And I feel like the content is always going to be out there. And I wonder, I mean, like, I hear your point, but I wonder if it's, like, not at least better that people talk about things in a way that is open and direct and honest and complete, rather than this, like, weird, illicit way that we learned about it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip. cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right, before we move on, let's do the business. As always, if you have a question that you would like us to answer on the show, leave us a message at 424-255-7833, or you can send us an email at momanddad@slate.com. As a reminder, we have moved our Facebook presence. I keep talking about how everybody should leave the old Mom and Dad Are Fighting page and join the Slate Parenting Facebook group. I think I'm going to stop talking about it because it's so cool and fun and lively and active in there that I don't want any more people coming in because they could only make it worse. So whatever you do, do not join the fun, engaging discussion at facebook.com/groups/Slate Parenting. And certainly don't search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. I want to tell you about another great Slate show. It's called Working. It's our show about what people do all day. In the past, the hosts have interviewed a schooner captain, a community internet organizer, a hair entrepreneur, and Stephen Colbert. You should especially check out the recent episodes, How Does a Drag Queen Work? An interview with Ms. Cracker, who's now a contestant on RuPaul's Drag Race, and also the episode, How Does a Miniature Therapy Horse Work?, about the day job of a very special 100-pound horse named Magic. That show is called Working. Search for Working wherever you get your podcasts. On Slate Plus today, we're going to hear from Carvel about his son Ezra's pursuit of a diagnosis around ADD and ADHD. Here's a little teaser of that segment.
I felt like I was a bad person. And Ezra feels like he's a bad person. And we're trying to, change that and communicate that, but I don't know that we can.
To hear that segment and another like it every week, sign up for Slate Plus. For just $35 for your first year, you get an extended ad-free version of every episode of this show and other great Slate podcasts, and you also help us make this show. Go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's take a question. This was emailed to us by a listener. It's being read for us by Slate Culture intern Lena Wilson.
Dear Mom and Dad Are Fighting, I'm a mom of a 2.5-year-old girl. Shortly after she was born, she was diagnosed with a microdeletion of her DNA. It's pretty rare, which is part of my question. So if you read the small paragraph of information in the literature, which is what doctors usually do when I mention it, it mentions physical and mental disabilities, bipolar disorder, autism, etc. None of these describe my daughter. However, we do remain on high alert as she grows for bipolar disorder and autism. My question is, while we want her teachers to help us monitor for abnormalities, we don't want them to box her in. Our pediatrician has even said there's a risk of people assuming things about her if they know of the deletion when she goes to elementary school, i.e. not challenging her in school. We started her in daycare this year, and we didn't share her history with the teachers, but we did with the school and the paperwork. Her teachers and I did have discussions around some of my concerns, and we did have early intervention come in for services at their suggestion. When we did the team meeting, I gave more specific information I have on the deletion to her teachers. I apologize for hiding it from them, although they understood my reasoning. The issues she currently has relate to chewing, social anxiety, and some sensory issues, but not anywhere near what is described in the literature. I'd prefer to discuss her specific issues. I know there's an underlying fear of her being put into special ed and not needing it, although if she needed it, we would accept and deal with it. I know it's a dumb fear, but I don't want her to be defined by a diagnosis. I guess my question is, what's your take on that? Do I share from the start? Do I not and bring it up only when necessary? Am I being dishonest or am I protecting my child? This relates to a lot of situations. Elementary school, gymnastics class, as they ask about conditions as well, etc. My husband and I both have concerns about sharing it, although we can't explain these feelings well. Sincerely, Melissa.
Okay. thanks for this letter. This is a really interesting situation and an interesting problem. First of all, it doesn't seem complicated to me that you might have qualms about immediately presenting all of the information that you have about your daughter's genetic condition when the information that you have is so ambiguous and so unclear, and the way in which it connects to her present experience is impossible to ascertain. It definitely seems like if the first thing you do when you introduce a kid to people who are going to be working with her or taking care of her or teaching her gymnastics is, oh, well, she has what's called a microdeletion in her DNA, and that can lead to autism and other kinds of conditions, and so let's be on the lookout for these things. Inevitably, that's going to color the way people see her. Now, we might say, well, it shouldn't color the way people see her, or it shouldn't color the way people see her in any negative ways. But I think we know that the world isn't like that, and that if you frame people in that way, then you are cueing other people to treat them in a particular set of ways. And those ways might be helpful and appropriate, and they might not be helpful and they might not be appropriate. And so I think it makes sense that you're wondering, well, when do we give other people this information, and when do we only tell them the things that we're actually certain about, which is, this is our daughter, here's how old she is, she has these issues with chewing and sensory stuff and so on. So it makes sense to me that this is a concern. In terms of when you should actually be telling people, Rebecca, tell me what you think about this.
Well, for one, if your daughter goes to public school, there's no way they're going to put her in special ed unless they feel they absolutely have to. It is really difficult for parents who want to get their kids extra services to get them. And I'm not saying this happens all the time, but it often happens where, you know, schools are often reticent to give kids IEPs and put them in special programs. However, there is some benefit to There can be some benefit anyway, depending on your school situation, to setting up what's called a 504 with your school. I'm not a super expert on this, except I've been through it with one of our kids, Teddy, which is basically that it basically just says, this is what is going on with the kid, and this is the agreement that we make with teachers, and all the teachers know about it. And Teddy's 504 that he still has in ninth grade has really evolved. It evolves over time. It's a living document. And right now what it basically says is, if you think he's in real trouble in your class and is getting to a point where he can't or won't be able to catch up, if he hasn't handed in assignments and you feel like it's getting beyond what you think he can handle and catch up in, please make sure to loop us in before you might loop other parents in, because we know this is like a long-term pattern, yada, yada, yada. So it's kind of loose right now. But I will say that I think that this writer in her is introspective enough to understand that some of these issues about telling teachers in particular might kind of be about her fears about having a kid who potentially someday may need more, may need something different, and how difficult a journey maybe she's seen other people go through around that, or, you know, having a kid that people label as different, that kind of thing. That's all super understandable. But if you have a good relationship with your daughter's school and a good relationship with your teachers, and that relationship includes things like saying, I really want my daughter to be challenged. I don't want you to put her in a box. Not having them not have the information, if they do notice something, not having the information won't allow them to be able to be helpful and communicate with you. So I don't think it's necessary for you to tell her gymnastics instructor everything about her or any kid when your kid starts gymnastics class. But on the school side, I don't know. I err on the side of more just giving more information, being more communicative, and being clear. You can be clear about what you're afraid of happening too. And, you know, if your school is proactive, if you have a good relationship with them, they should take that into account as well.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that it's not as complex. I mean, I think there's a lot there, but I think strategically, I would also not tell people about this. I mean, I would say, I don't know that I would go into detail. I would be very judicious about how I sort of flagged my kid in the relationship with other adult caregivers. Like in the case that Rebecca pointed out, if I felt like I needed to be warned maybe slightly ahead of time, If the kid was struggling in some way academically, I might just say that. I might not say why. I might not say necessarily. I would say that, like, you know, we're worried about their ability to keep up sometimes, and we think they're okay, but we want to make sure, and so we're keeping an eye on it. So if you see anything, let us know. But I do think that even people that you have good relationships with, and even institutions that you have good relationships with, there's just always factors at play that you don't quite, know about. And I think that what you're talking about is not something, but the potential for something. And I think it should be discussed openly when and if it becomes something that actually has an impact, but not necessarily before it has an impact, is my feeling. Gabe, what do you think?
Yeah, that seems right to me as well, that like if you are watching her closely, we're all watching our kids closely, but if you know a particular set of things that you're looking out for and you're checking in with her teachers a little bit and they know that you want to be kept in touch, that seems more important and maybe more productive than giving them a list of conditions that there's some chance that she might have due to a condition that nobody really knows very much about and that she hasn't evidenced any very clear signs of yet. That kind of close observation seems more useful and less likely to be counterproductive to me.
Yeah, but the thing with the communication is that the other side of the coin is accountability, right? And process. And you know, if there is some sort of, like, say, very minor difference. I mean, she mentioned chewing, right? Without that piece of information, how is a teacher to know to, for instance, not like correct a behavior? I'm chewing maybe isn't the best example, but how to try to correct or develop a behavior that just might be more difficult? Like, how is a teacher supposed to know how to know whether or not something isn't as it used to be and that there might be an underlying reason for it? I mean, there is some comfort in having some kind of documentation with the school. And the reason that I've, you know, been comfortable with the 504 process is because it also allows me to be able to say, like, when the thing that I've asked for hasn't happened, like, I can say, you know, why hasn't this happened? Because it's, you know, it's in the 504. It's the agreement that we all signed at the beginning of the year. It actually, it's a helpful tool on both sides of the coin. And the other thing that I think, you know, this mom should know is that there are a lot of parents at your daughter's school asking themselves the same questions, and there are a lot of kids with notes in their file about things that teachers might want to be on the lookout for, or, you know, behavioral issues or ADHD or a disability that, you know, may not be super obvious, you know, upon meeting a kid. There are a lot of parents and a lot of kids in your situation. So maybe it'll give you some comfort to know that, but I don't know. I think it's fine that we're all on different pages here, but I just imagine if I were that teacher, you know, what if I didn't know? And what if I thought there was a problem? Sort of the discomfort in trying to communicate to this mom might lead to a worse situation than not feeling like I could communicate it because it was something that I had a little bit of knowledge about to begin with. Does that make sense?
But that is the problem, is that there's, well, yeah, but it does. But that is the problem, is that there's so little knowledge that it makes me wonder that it's one of those situations where, like, a little bit of knowledge is worse than none at all. Like, it isn't like we understand this whole complete thing and here's all this information, here's all everything it totally means, and here's what you do about it and here's how you deal with it, but we're just not going to tell you because we're afraid you're going to judge us. It's the actual issue that this parent is facing is the lack of clarity and information.
That's right.
So I feel like that as a teacher, that puts you in, that's like not helpful. It's just like someone being like, there's a terrible thing, but I don't know where it is or how close to you or what it's going to do. So just thought I'd let you know.
Right.
Anyway, enjoy your work. Like, it's not helpful information. That's kind of the way I feel about it.
What we know is this is
the problem is that as a teacher, you know, and again, like, I don't know a specific teacher, that some people are great, some people are not, but you have to think of things as an institution, because school is unfortunately an institution. People will then fill in the unknowns with a lot of stuff, and a lot of that stuff might be unhelpful.
Right.
So I feel like this is information for the parent at this point.
What we know is this is a 2.5-year-old girl who, there's a possibility that she's going to develop physical and mental disabilities, bipolar disorder, autism, etc. In a way, that applies to every 2.5-year-old kid, right? every kid might end up developing disabilities, might end up being diagnosed with autism or with bipolar disorder. You want teachers to be watching out for signs of those things. But until this kid manifests actual signs of the things, does it help the teachers necessarily to be on especially high alert for any sign of those things?
Right.
I can see in some situations it might, but I can also see in a lot of situations where that would just make it harder for them to do what this kid needs to help them develop and grow.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's a tough one, though. I hope this has been helpful in some way. As you can see, all of us immediately agree on – we all have different instincts about how you might go ahead with this. So at least you should know that if you're feeling confused and uncertain, well, so are the hosts of Slate's Parenting Podcast.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now is the time on our show when we recommend things to you. Rebecca, do you recommend something?
Yes. Mine is a video. It is a news report from a local news station, KOB-TV, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have watched this video probably 100 times in the last week. I shared it in the newsroom where I work, and I've made my kids watch it a bunch, and we all think it's hilarious. This intrepid reporter, Caleb Jones, this is one of those things where you can tell he was sent on an assignment in the morning and then, you know, at some point during the day decided, like, there's nothing here. But his editor was just like, no, we really need this story for the 6 o'clock news. And the story was that there was a Google Street image in their city where someone had pulled their pants down and mooned the camera. So Caleb Jones does this news report with so much humor and graceful writing. At one point, he does a reenactment of the scene of the mooning.
You know, it really isn't until you come here to the scene that you really get a firm grasp on the fact that our mooner was equal parts opportunist and quick thinker. Based on our reconstruction, it's likely he relied on that distraction caused by those middle finger flingers over here before walking over, resting his bag right here on this ledge, resourceful, before bending over, dropping trowel to deliver that midday moon.
At one point he says, you know, I really haven't learned much today, but we all have to admit it was a pretty funny picture. And it is just, it's exactly what you want a reporter to do when they've been sent out like on a ridiculous and stupid story. And it makes for like a really fun video to watch with your kids, because if you've ever seen like a terrible local news fail, you know how funny they can be and you know how much kids love talking about butts. So I will post a link to this video on the Facebook group, facebook.com/group/Slate Parenting. I'll make sure to post the video there so you can all check it out. But if you want to Google it, look up KOB-TV, Caleb Jones, Moon Google Street View. And that's pretty much all you need to find it. And I guarantee your kids are going to love this little news package.
Nice. All right. I have a recommendation, which is something we did for the first time this weekend. I think we did this for the first time since our daughter was born, which is we hired a babysitter in the afternoon and went out on a daytime afternoon date instead of like getting the babysitter to put the kids to bed and then sit in your house and watch TV while you're out having dinner. And going out on a date in the afternoon is so fun because you are not exhausted and you're not like desperately trying to cram it in, and the kids have fun with the babysitter. And we went to the Museum of Modern Art and then we went out and had dinner. And then we came home just in time to put them to bed. And then we got to watch television ourselves instead of paying somebody else to do it. So my recommendation is get a babysitter and go out on a date in the afternoon.
That is wonderful.
It was great.
Because your babysitter can also do stuff with your kids in the afternoon, right?
Right.
Like in a way that they can't at night.
Right.
They can't at night. Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. That's really good. I'm going to recommend a book that we just received, and the kids have almost have barely had a chance to look at it. But when I was researching the Black Panther piece for the New York Times, I talked to a professor named John Jennings, who had so many great things to say about the history of Black comic books. But he also told me in that conversation that he had been working on this book called Black Comics Returns, which is basically a long, like a beautiful coffee table compilation of comic book art by all these Black artists over the course of the last, you know, 20 years or so. And it's just a beautiful book. And we just got it in the mail. We ordered from the Kickstarter project that they had launched maybe a year ago to get this thing funded. It's now out in the world. It's on Amazon. And we just, because it came like, and we had to leave the house in the morning, we just briefly had the briefest time of looking at it. But already there's like so much to get into. So if you are raising a person who's into comic books, this is like such a great compendium of all these different kinds of artists. And I guarantee that any kid who's in, or adult who's interested in comics, will find something in here that they're like, wow, I've never seen this artist before. I didn't know you could draw like that. I didn't know you could tell stories like that. Let me find out more. So it's a good way to get to find all new directions to go into with comic books. It's called Black Comics Returns. It's by Damian Duffy, Ashley Woods, and John Jennings. And we'll put the link on the Slate page.
Awesome. And that's our show. If you have a question you would like us to address, you can call us at 424-255-7833. Let us know what you thought of the show at that Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/Slate Parenting, or just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. Our show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvell Wallace and Rebecca Lavoy, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we'll see you next week.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.